The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by Avantcard Reward Plus Credit Card. Powered by MasterCard. Straight up better than your current credit card. Avantcard DAC is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.
Now then, you're very welcome back. So we are looking now to review the Sunday Papers. Shane Lowry made that putt for bogey, and it was a brilliant putt for bogey in the end. It was about 7 feet. He gave a fist pump. Never was a man happier to make a bogey. And Tommy Fleetwood missed his birdie putt. So in the end, it could have been a two-shot swing. It was just a one-shot drop for Lowry, back to 15 under. Tommy Fleetwood goes to 12 under. Still a three-shot lead for Lowry, and he heads to the second, where he's just off the fairway, but only just off the fairway with a good drive on the second. Lee Westwood 9 under, Justin Rose 9 under. Koepka has dropped back to 8 under after bogey in the first as well. So that is where we are. We'll be over to John Duggan across the course of this hour. The back pages of the Sunday Papers in no particular order. Shane of Thrones, as you might imagine, Shane Lowry after his 63 yesterday is everywhere in the back pages. Shane of Thrones, it's open and shut as Lowry blows field apart at Portrush, is Bob Gibson up in Portrush for the Sunday World. Sun Sport, runaway Shane. Lowry stuns with record 63. Again, a picture of Lowry being cheered on by everybody behind him. The scenes were kind of amazing yesterday if you didn't catch them. Chance of ole ole around Portrush, which was quite something. We have the mirror then. Lowry paints such a pretty picture. Shane's masterpiece has Portrush galleries purring. A superb 63 puts him just one round from immortality. And it's not far off it really. This would just transform his career, Shane Lowry, if he could get the job done today. Sunday Independent again, it's Lowry's day of destiny. Shane Lowry is celebrating a birdie on the 15th hole. Dermot Gleese writes, destiny beckons Shane Lowry at a time and a place of splendid achievement. Beneath that, Conway confirms intention to remain on FAI board. This was Dan McDonald yesterday at the FAI's EGM. Donald Conway very much confirming his intention to defy the wishes of the Minister for Sport, Shane Ross, by pressing ahead with his plan to stay on for another year as part of an interim board. Sunday Times sports section, because there is the Sunday Times main news section, which we'll come to now. Again, it's Lowry. Lowry's masterpiece, inspired Irishman, shoots a stunning 63 to take four-shot lead into today's final round of the Open. And an interesting story here, Paul Rowan, Croke Park favoured for a Football World Cup opener. The 2030 World Cup bid is being prepared by the UK and the Republic of Ireland, and it seems that Croke Park could host the opener. The FAI is preparing to step up efforts to bring the GA on board. The GA were asked for comment in this story, by the way. They said yesterday, not in a position to comment as no formal approach has been made. And the FAI refused to comment as well, saying no bid has been confirmed. But certainly it seems there is going to be a joint bid for the 2030 World Cup. Republic of Ireland and UK, Croke Park would be hosting games. I presume the Aviva Stadium would as well. They've been told that the 52,000 capacity Aviva Stadium is too small to host the opening game, but it could be used for a quarterfinal. One of 14 games which would be played in Ireland under the plans. So 14 World Cup games potentially in the Republic of Ireland would be quite something in 2030. Mail on Sunday then. Lowry gets ready for final push after firing fantastic 63, goes four clear in Portrush. Open doors, the headline. And then something we might touch on here, Philip Quinn. Solskjaer turns to Roy Keane in bid to revive United. There's an interview inside with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. We'll touch on Joe Bernstein has done that. And in it, Solskjaer reveals he's turned to Roy Keane for advice on how to handle the upcoming season. I keep in touch with Roy. I've already been at his house for a cup of tea. I always listen to Roy and his opinions. I value them very highly. He said, I know Roy did an interview saying there's many people who claim to be his friends, but I do feel we are quite close and we've become friends. That's Solskjaer there. And then Sunday Times front page news section, as has been the case over the last 2-3 months, the FAI feature. The headline is Delaney used FAI funds for his 50th party. Although that is not quite the story in the piece, which suggests that John Delaney was being investigated in relation to four separate allegations when he agreed to go on gardening leave. So the Sunday Times has established that the FAI had resolved to investigate Delaney over concern that he, one, failed to use his FAI credit card properly, two, failed to manage the finances of the FAI, three, failed to control his personal expenses, and four, made a series of payments from FAI funds not in the ordinary business of FAI business. made a series of payments from FAI funds, not in the ordinary course of FAI business. So he was being investigated on those four fronts when he accepted that he would have to go on gardening leave, but they're still very much open investigations, we should stress. We're joined here in studio by Andy Dunn, formerly of Harlequins, Connacht and Leinster, and Shane Keegan, former manager of Wexford Youths and Galway United. Gents, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Joe.
Thanks for being with us. Shane, every time you're in, there's a Sunday Times splash on the FAI. You have the Midas touch.
I do. We're having a bit of a laugh as to whether myself and Mark Tighe have ever been spotted in the same room at the same time, because, third time I've been in, third time Mark Tighe has had a front page story about John Delaney, but as has been the case with all his previous work, this is superb. Seems to have managed to get his hands on the minutes of some meetings, or somebody who was sitting in the room seems to have spilled the beans. I don't know what the source is, but look, when you turn to page 4 and 5, if you were to quote all the relevant bits and all the bits that are worthwhile talking about, you'd take up the whole show and you'd be left with no article. But look, it's super, super stuff. And unsurprisingly, some people don't come out of it shining brightly again.
Yeah. The nature of the pay-per-view, I'm sure you'll all accept, is that we choose the guests well in advance of the actual papers coming out. We don't suddenly get up on Sunday morning and say, who will we get in today, and start ringing around. So, Andy, you're not as on top of this whole area as others might be, certainly not well enough to force your opinions on the national airwaves. So
Correct. We'll
get your thoughts on what you've read today.
To you.
And Shane, you've been on the record, and I think appropriately so, because it's not right if media come on and don't present all the facts as saying that you may well apply for jobs in the FAI in the future.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That is worth stating, and people can make up their minds on that, or you know, how that might inform your thoughts on the story or not. You're not here as a journalist, you're here as a guest to review
Absolutely.
The Sunday papers. I saw a few people tweeting in last time we said that, saying it was crazy, but actually it's the reality of the pay per view. We booked the guests early in the week, we don't know what's going to be in the papers, and we're just being totally honest and upfront with people. That's the nature of how it all works. So page 4 and 5 is a big piece. I'll hold it up here for cameras for those of you who are watching, and you'll see it's well, two-page spread, and the headline is How Delaney Lost the FAI Dressing Room. And as Shane, you say rightly, it seems Mark Tighe and Paul Rowan have got their hands on the minutes of various board meetings, FAI board meetings, which happened around the last couple of months when the SH1T was hitting the fan. And so it makes for good reading and informative reading to see how the board handled this whole situation. So that's kind of our jumping off point.
Yeah.
Where do you want to start? I think maybe going through it chronologically might make most sense for people, because there's a lot in it.
Well, that's it. I suppose I think the two most impressive things about the way the piece has been put together, obviously it's brilliant journalism just to get their hands on the information they've got on it, but then it still requires serious work to make a decent piece out of it. And the two most impressive things about it is the way that it has managed to follow a timeline, and allows you to, it almost takes you inside the boardroom on each of these various different meetings, and we get the key discussion points. And then it's also superb in that it's very, very much explained in layman's terms. Like, right, I'm involved in football, but I wouldn't be massively, you know, into this side of it or all that well educated, but I feel an awful lot more educated on the back of this. Look, I suppose if you skip to the start of the second section of it, he kicks it off with on the 1st of March. That's when they initially sent the Times initially sent the questions in to the FAI. He skips forward then a few days to the 4th of March when the board had a meeting. And he brings up a couple of points that were discussed at first before saying that John Delaney at this meeting kind of casually mentioned that he had provided some cash due to a cash flow issue.
March 1st, Sunday Times sent the email to the FAI asking about the €100,000 loan of 2017. So that's March 1st. 3 days later, there's an FAI board meeting. It's in Abbottstown. Delaney, he says, informed the board of his recent activities, including dinner with Kieran Mulvey, including addressing a dinner hosted by Western Care, a disability support group in Mayo. He said he'd visited Iceland and Latvia on behalf of UEFA because two local association presidents were in trouble, ironically, quote unquote, in trouble. And then towards the end, as you say, Delaney said there were two things he wanted to mention. Mention is in quotes, so they could be noted in the minutes. He said most of his UEFA salary would go into the FAI for 2018. That's €160,000 a year. And then he mentioned that he had to bridge cash flow. That's a quote for the body, quote, for a small period of time, and that had been repaid very quickly. An interesting point to note here, when you're looking at the board and the job they did, No mention was made of the query from the Sunday Times, and no director asked for more information about why the FAI needed the loan from its chief executive. So that bears repeating. He mentions, I gave the association a loan of €100,000, and it seems no director asked why.
It seems incredible.
Doesn't it?
That seems absolutely incredible in any organisation, sporting or otherwise, for that scenario to raise its head and nobody to ask serious questions.
We did get onto the FAI for comment on the Sunday Times today, and they said they don't comment on matters pertaining to any employees, which I'm not sure that's overly satisfactory given the circumstances, but they were given the right to comment on this situation. We should stress that. Fast forward, also in that meeting was the first time Delaney mentioned this Jonathan Hall report. Yeah. And this was the report which ultimately would suggest he take up the newly created position of Executive Vice President. So he said that would be beginning, although ultimately it transpired it happened the night of the Gibraltar game. It certainly wasn't planned to happen that night, as we'll see. So where are we skimming to next? When's the next board meeting? That was the 4th of March.
Yeah, they kind of jump forward to middle of March. I would just point out first, though, there's two or three examples in the piece of how John Delaney was viewed by board members at that particular moment in time. So Pádraig Traynor remarked that if Delaney were not available, the FAI would need three people to replace him. Michael Cody, the Honorary Secretary, said that if the FAI did not act on Delaney's proposal, it might lose him, and that would be a disaster. So fair play to John Delaney doing the work of three men at the time.
The piece actually opens with board minutes, we assume, from 2012, where Delaney had said, well, FAI staff who took a temporary pay cuts of 10 to 15% in 2012, this is 2016, sorry, but they were talking about the pay cuts of 2012. He advised that of the 10, 15% pay cuts that staff had taken, maybe they could manage a 3% restoration. That would be about right. And then the same day he left the room because he wanted his contract, which was due to expire in 2020, to be extended for an extra 4 years. And the board members all agreed that the extension should be granted and were complimentary about his performance. So he was very much onside, given that the piece is how he lost the dressing room. The piece fast forwards to March 17th, St. Patrick's Day. The Sunday Times publishes the details of the 100 grand loan. That's on March 17th. 4 days later, the Thursday, FAI board meets. At this stage, you'll remember the FAI, writes Ty and Rowan, had been issuing daily press releases in an effort to try and calm things down. So Delaney, according to this piece, remarked at the meeting that he and Carl Durvin, the press relations officer, believed the story would, quote, have died down by now. He said, and this is interesting for Shane Ross, he said he and Donal Conway had spoken to Shane Ross, the sports minister, at the FAI Football Awards on the day the story was published, and he had, quote, been fine. So Shane Ross, on the day the story was published, had been fine, but he reckoned Ross had obviously come under, quote, a bit of political pressure, as he had written to them on Thursday, seeking an explanation of the transaction. One board member said the media coverage sounded like a witch hunt. That was the situation. That was the initial reaction 4 days after it first arose in the media, the 100 grand loan.
I think the fact that we're getting quotes is great, because it really, the terminology used really puts you in the mindset of some of the people in the room at the time as well. You know, for John Delaney to have said that he believed it would have all died down by now.
Yeah.
And how long ago, what's that, how many months ago now, and here we are still talking. It just shows how much he misjudged how big that was going to become. Yeah, they went on to discuss the Jonathan Hall report, and John Delaney seemed anxious to make a move on that and start implementing that as quickly as possible.
Well, one member dials into the meeting and he struggles to hear, so he's obviously on a speaker phone, and he asked that the discussion of the Hall report be postponed, and Delaney said it'd be circulated that day. He advised directors to read it because, quote, in a nuclear position, the board would have to progress, quote, immediately. The member dialing in repeated, says Mark Ty and Paul Rowan, that he could not hear all that was being said. And Delaney said that the utopia position was to review the whole report and deal with it the following week, but time potentially was of the essence. So he talked about the nuclear option. And he also told them that there would be protest, quote, stuff. There'd be protest, quote, stuff in Gibraltar. He noted a Father Ted reference, which was the flag using Delaney's face, reading, the money was just resting in their account, which is kind of comical. And Delaney said it would be uncomfortable in the small stadiums, given how small the stadium was, FAI contingent near the press and near the Irish supporters. So that brings us up to the Friday, the day before the Gibraltar game, when the Sunday Times are asking about the payments of up to €3,000 for his accommodation. And it's at 10 p.m. that day that the FAI have a phone conference.
Where are you going? I mean, now we're jumping all over the place. The bit he goes into the conversations that took place that day.
I have it here. Sorry. So 10 p.m. that day, Conway opens the call. This is all by conference call, and says that he wants to sign off on the whole report that created the position of executive vice president. Delaney told the board the move would, quote, take the heat off and resolve current issues. So, I mean, it's funny. Like, this is all as we suspected.
Yep.
You know, on the outside, when you're looking at the timing of the Donovan Hall report, it was done the night of the Gibraltar game. It was clearly to try and get the heat off them. And then you literally have a quote here in this piece, minutes of the board saying this would take the heat off and would resolve current issues. This was their thinking, even though it almost did the opposite.
Yeah, and if you refer to the piece below, it gives a little bit more detail on that.
Yeah.
The headline just above it is Trio decide best form of PR defence was attack. So the trio that he's referring to here is John Delaney, Donald Conway and Cathal Durbin. And yeah, that basically the idea was to put this press release out at the same time that the latest time stuff was to come out. I think the phrase they used was to take the focus away. Mm. He assured this strategy would force the papers to amend their stories about Delaney and the FAI, and referred to it as a situation which would result in a nil-nil draw at a time when the FAI was currently down.
I do like that the FAI are using football analogies to explain things. It gets us back in the game, is what was said.
The other interesting part from that, if you jump towards the end of that meeting, it says that he is Delaney. He said to the board, and then the quotation marks, he said the board stood together and go down together.
Yeah.
Which you can draw your own conclusions from what he was trying to tell them.
In this piece, Ronan Ty write that a number of members at this board meeting around the Gibraltar game to create the executive vice president role said a number of members said they had not had time to read the report.
Again,
you know,
priorities.
The way this was operating.
Priorities.
So we kick on. Next board meeting is on March 26th. This is the afternoon of the Georgia match. So this is the day of the Georgia match where there would be a tennis ball protest. And the board, it seems, are starting now to think.
Yeah, he claims this was the first sign of dissent.
Yeah.
But again, you know, John is swinging as well. He's not shying away from it at all. He himself says he felt he could have been better defended by the FAI, as he could not defend himself. He told him at this meeting. At this stage, Jim McConnell, a board member, asked why Delaney had not informed the board of the 100,000 transaction sooner.
Yeah.
Delaney said that senior people were aware of it, but I mean, this essentially is the first time anybody on the board has said,
yeah, what's the
actually
story?
We have a bit of an issue around this 100,000 thing.
Certainly that we're seeing in these minutes that are reported. Maybe someone said it earlier, but certainly insofar as we can see. And the response from Delaney, it seems, according to the minutes, was it was a good thing to do and it was a way to avoid any bad publicity. I sort of understand that. I do, actually. That's the first bit of logic, actually, on this whole 100 grand loan that we've seen, that it was to avoid bad publicity. But it's still not acceptable. It wasn't in the accounts. You would have to say, on balance, it has to be in the audited accounts when this happens. So, I mean, that's a good chunk of all these board minutes. Anything else then grab you as things progress?
You'd still wonder about the mindset of people in the room. I mean, it says that at that particular meeting that Donald Conway asked Mr. Delaney to leave the room at that time, and they go on to have a discussion while he's not in the room. The FAI discussed setting up a board subcommittee to investigate financial matters, but it was noted John is not happy and has some nervousness about it.
Yeah.
So, like, we don't set up the subcommittee to investigate this because John might not be happy with us setting up a subcommittee to investigate him. Is that what's been said there? You know, it is very, very strange. And the other really interesting part I thought from that was the board then instructed Durbin that he release statements only on instruction from Conway or Watch. So whose instructions was he releasing statements?
I presume Delaney would have had some say in statements being released. So that, again, that was the beginning of the turning, I suppose, in that they want to control the message. And it seems, if we take that as fact, that they wanted to stop John Delaney releasing statements, or being part of those statements being released.
Yeah, also at that one, it has here, Eamon Nocton said that while he knew of the loan, he felt Delaney had given conflicting versions of what had taken place. Mm. You know, I think Eamon would be seen as somebody who had probably been in John's corner to a reasonable extent up until then. So, you know, you've got people who are starting to finally maybe starting to move away from him at this stage, you know.
I mean, it's very interesting, Reid. It does all tally with what you suspected was going on. A bit of troubleshooting, a bit of firefighting, trying to steer the media away from things. The Jonathan Hall report rushed through under the pressure. The sense initially that this thing would die down in a fortnight. Shane Ross going from saying it's fine to Shane Ross writing letters. Yep. The pressure building. Eventually around that Gibraltar-Georgia game, board members starting to pipe up and starting to say, well, hang on, why didn't we? When you think about it, you know, why didn't we know about the 100 grand loan? Now that I stop and think about it, a lot of people are saying it's wrong. Maybe it wasn't so good. That it all ties in with the public, I was going to say perception, but the suspicions about how this thing was unfolding behind the scenes. That is the sense you get.
Very much so. It's the kind of article where three different people could read that and they will zone in on three different things as being the main talking point on the back of it, really, depending on who your focus is on. Shane Ross, John Delaney, Donald Conway, you know, there's various different bits of material there that allows you to have a crack at varying different people, really.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how it informs the current situation, the current impasse around Donald Conway's position. Dan McDonald, front page of the Sunday Independent. Donald Conway, and all the papers have this, they're all writing about this because they were at the EGM yesterday. Donald Conway confirming he's going to stay on and wants to stay on as president. Sport Ireland told the Dáil committee during the week they would prefer if the long-serving board member stepped away immediately following the spell. John Tracy has said something similarly. So, you know, you wonder how the Sunday Times story today informs this current situation. You suspect it doesn't do the FAI board and anyone who was on it any favours, including Donald Conway.
Absolutely. I actually heard... heard Dan talking on the radio station, on your own radio station, as I was driving up, and he was very good, obviously, talking on the situation. He's well clued in on it. And he was saying, yeah, you've got this awkward situation where, rightly, they're trying to move towards, right, what's next? How do we clean all this up? But it's just so hard to clean it up when you don't know what it is fully yet.
Yeah.
You're trying to look back and look forward at the same time. It's quite the juggling act.
Yeah, they adopted, I'm sure you may have seen yesterday, the 78 recommendations the FAI did of the Governance Review Group. This is a weird one because these are recommendations that the Governance Review Group put forward, but at the same time, there are now people saying, well, this is happening too fast. And I'm not sure why it's happening too fast, these 78 recommendations, but certainly various people have made that point that it's all been rushed through, maybe in a bid to preempt some of the reports that are going to come out and won't reflect favourably on the FAI. The Mazars report, writes Dan, could be ready by August or September, and there is a Sport Ireland commissioned audit as well, which has been carried out by a Northern Irish firm. September being talked about as a prospective date there, because adopting all these 78 proposals was one of the steps necessary, writes Dan, for the restoration of government funding. But he says Sport Ireland's appearance in front of the Oireachtas Committee last Wednesday made it clear that there are more hurdles to jump, and Conway accepted that yesterday. So I don't know what happens with Sport Ireland funding if they adopt the 78 proposals, but they don't want Conway to stay on and Conway decides to stay on.
Yeah.
They haven't actually been clear whether or not that means funding gets halted.
Yeah, and I think it's important to mention, as Dan does in the article, that, you know, there's different people coming down on different sides of the Donald Conway thing. I think a lot are coming down on one particular side, the side of that he shouldn't have any involvement going forward. But Dan does bring up the point that the Governance Review Group, a joint venture between Sport Ireland and the FAI, recommended that up to two serving board members stay on for an interim period of 12 months. So, okay, lads, if you don't want it to be Donald Conway, it's going to be somebody.
Yeah.
You know, somebody has to stick around here, because you can't have nobody who knew what was going on in the last regime, in the new setup. So, I mean, if Donald Conway's intentions are to be one of those two people for that 12-month period, then, you know, I think that may possibly actually be a good thing in a roundabout way.
I don't see it as outlandish.
Yeah.
Certainly.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the makeup of that board, obviously, is going to be probably the key thing that comes out from the 78 recommendations. Again, Dan gives us a bit of information in the makeup of that board. I think the key part will be the four independent members. It's going to be really, really interesting to see who they have there, because they are the people who are, you'd imagine, going to come in with absolutely no baggage and who could really, really bring some new thinking to the whole thing. So it's going to be very important to see that. I've also recommended at least four females again, which is probably a very, very good thing. So yeah, all change and no change, I suppose.
People will read that and they'll get a sense of how the board was operating. Any final thoughts to make on it?
Look, I don't know. You hear so much. The one thing I've said before is, look, probably even, you know, to be fully honest about it, it's even more so, okay, you've said at the start that you know, I may apply for FAI jobs. I'm actually doing bits and pieces for them here and there, which leads into contact with a lot of FAI staff at the moment. And like the whole thing, I know we're talking about the top level here, but there are some incredible people involved at grassroots level.
Yeah.
People who, okay, it's probably been dragging on a while now, it's probably even more than 2 years ago, but 3-4 years ago, would knock you down with their enthusiasm and who you think are set to change the world in favour of the FAI. And they're drained. They're absolutely drained. Morale is just incredibly on the floor.
Heard that from a few different people.
Oh, it's amazing. It really is. And, you know, something has to happen to get all this moving back in the right direction, because at the moment it seems like we could be doing a Sunday paper review in 6 to 12 months' time and still have a conversation like this.
Yeah. Well, your heart sinks at the thoughts of all these reports coming down the line. August, September, there's going to be a litany of them. Yeah. Okay, well, that's in the Sunday Times news section again. Mark Tighe to the fore and Paul Rowan on the very front page and within. That two-page spread is a really good read if you want to get... We've done our best to try and break it down. It's obviously fairly heavy going and can be hard to digest on the radio, but basically it is a snapshot of pretty much, what, 5, 6, 7 board meetings from the start of March when this whole thing blew up and the various reactions from people and how they tried to salvage the thing, and then how around the Georgia game things turned on John Delaney and ultimately gardening leave was suggested. So that's on page 4 and 5 of the main section as opposed to the sports section.
The one, Joe, just very quickly, the one that the only priority we didn't mention on it, of course, was, which is also on the front page, is the bit about the guards being called in to possibly try and hack into a WhatsApp group.
Oh yeah.
They just touch on that as well, that the WhatsApp group set up by some supporters, they actually named two of the supporters. The reason I bring it up is one I'd know very well. One is a guy involved with Galway United who would have been quite decent to me when I was up there. And yeah, it appears as though the FAI managed to persuade the guards that, I don't know, potentially John might be in a bit of bother, and that's why it was would have been worthwhile hacking into this WhatsApp group to see what they were saying around the protest and make sure there was no plans to get at him, I suppose, really.
Yeah, okay. There's various strands to this. You'll excuse us for keeping an eye on the golf. Shane Larry has a birdie putt on the fourth, which he holds. This is getting serious now. Shane Larry has gone to 16 under. He's returned to 16 under. Bogey on the first, then par, and a really good birdie there on the fourth hole. It can be a tricky enough hole. Tommy Fleetwood didn't make his putt for birdie. It was from 30-odd feet, so he's tapped in for par. Shane Larry strolls to the fifth, which is a drivable par four with the COB right behind the green. Feeling pretty good about life. Suddenly that four-shot lead is back. First birdie of the day. He's looking very good out there. We'll keep you updated all afternoon. On the golf, there is wall-to-wall coverage all over the papers. A lot of it's about Larry, as you might imagine. So for the purposes of people who will be listening tomorrow and later on, we won't get too deep into that because the next few hours will dictate so much of what we have to say about Shane Larry. A few pieces on Rory McIlroy. Rory can't find an answer to the same old question, says James Corrigan. Dermot leaks McIlroy owes it to himself to challenge for more major titles. You found this very interesting, Andy. By the way, it's good to have you on. People for the last 25 minutes might not have heard much of you. You're back.
Mouse-like in the studio there.
There is an intelligence to saying nothing sometimes. So.
Well, yeah, I just... sometimes when you don't know, you don't know.
100%.
There wasn't any deference to John Delaney in any way.
No, I appreciate that. So where do you want to start here? You liked these pieces in Rory. You thought they were good.
Yeah, in the Sindo on page 7, Dermot Galease, the subheading is the lack of a competitive edge doesn't mean Rory's rivals simply don't fear him.
Yeah.
And
he describes how he was admirably courteous in his post-round interview on Thursday. But should he have been?
I was there for that, actually.
That resonated with me because any sports psychologist worth their salt would say all emotions are valid and being angry is valid. And he seems to have really gone down the road of being reflective and philosophical no matter how bad the day goes. And to go further on then, I think to talk about that 79 as an opening round, as an outlier, I think...
James Corrigan
says it's his third... It's his third opening round in a major since 2017 that was 78 or worse.
Yeah.
So 3 out of 11 majors. Can you describe that as an outlier?
It's a rhetorical question in the piece because the answer is fairly obvious.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I do. I mean, I just got a sense looking at Rory that he needs to get aggressive and he needs to get angry. Dermot Galease ponders, are many of his contemporaries intimidated by him when they stand up on the tee box? And it's an important part of all sport. If you look at how intimidating Djokovic is, even Federer is intimidating, but there doesn't seem to be a sense of menace about Rory, or a competitive sense of menace. I'm reading into the future, but I don't expect Brooks Koepka's interview tonight is going to be full of niceties and reflection.
He'll be peeved.
Yeah, and I think it's okay to be peeved and jealous of a winner and angry and not reaching your form. And I just think it's an area from a psychology point of view, I can only surmise how Rory is feeling. We can all only do that. But the lack of anger and the lack of fight in it seems to be worrying for me.
And could you defend him in that on the Friday there was lots of fight to make the cut and he was very emotional afterwards and almost broke down in tears? Or do you subscribe to the view which is out there that he does these kind of brilliant things when the real pressure is off, when it's about making the cut as opposed to winning the tournament?
Well, in recent history you would have to say the latter. Yeah, he once the hiccup has happened and the pressure is off, it seems to lighten his load. The incredible and at times unrivaled talent he has comes to the fore only after he's made the massive hiccup on day one. That's a really worrying trend in his own game. But more often than not, for me, it's the trend of reflective practice and philosophical practice, which is always good, but it seems to be almost without anger, and it's something at high level sport. You need that bitterness and drive and grit, particularly in a one man sport arena, even more so, I would have thought.
Because Corrigan, in his piece in the Telegraph, has a quote from McGinley on Sky. I was watching this last night, and McGinley said it, and it was one of those lines that just landed as soon as he said it. He said McElroy is like the brightest kid in the class. He has a tendency to daydream every now and then, and he was obviously saying you just can't do this at top level competition. Corrigan points out this is one of McElroy's best seasons. He leads the PGA Tour in strokes gained against the field off the tee, in strokes gained against the field from tee to green, in strokes gained against the field full stop. Nobody has amassed more top tens, 11, and only Brooks Koepka has earned more money between the ropes. 21st at the Masters, 8th at the USPGA, 9th at the US Open. On all three occasions, says Corrigan, he was not a factor at the business end. And McGinley also in that piece from Corrigan says, we've seen so much of this from McElroy, particularly in the majors. He gets himself out of contention and then he gets unburdened with expectation and runs through the field. Sometimes it results in him ending up in the top 10. Galease makes the point, this isn't a time for cheap shots, Dermot Galease here. This isn't a time for cheap shots at a seriously talented sports person. Rather, it's an attempt to understand why that talent seems to go wanting on the really big occasion. In the words of Tom Watson, great players have good focus. It means that in every shot, you know where to hit it and where not to hit it. You can picture the shot you want to play. That's essentially what you have to do to win major championships. And Galease speculates, winning came so easily to McElroy in his early years that he never felt the need, perhaps, to sharpen a competitive edge to the extent of becoming a fearsome opponent. And that phrase, a fearsome opponent, is not something actually you would apply to McElroy. He's not a fearsome opponent. He's a glorious player. And he's swashbuckling, but he's not a fearsome opponent. That's not his guise.
And to expand on the way Andy is putting it, like, is that something he can develop, or is that just your human nature? Do you know what I mean? Like, can he become a fearsome opponent, or is his personality, and it's going to override any attempts? He can go to the next interview and put a scowl on his face and be narky because he believes that that's what people need to see from him. But it probably still won't be him. It probably won't be what he does. I'm just thinking from a practical point of view. I kind of get him in that I'd maybe just going from personal experience, I'd maybe be a bit like that myself. Like, I've gone into dressing rooms and roared and shouted in a dressing room. I've roared and shouted because I believe that that's what the occasion required. I've never really roared and shouted because I've lost my own cool and therefore I roared and shouted. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you have to act in a particular way. Does he do that to try and come across a bit more fearsome? I don't think he will naturally be an intimidating and fearsome person. I don't know, is it in his nature?
Yeah. Kepke is not a loud, vociferous personality. If anything, his quietness and his self-control is what's so fearsome. Mm-hmm. Like, nothing, he doesn't, he's just relentlessly forward-looking and doesn't get frustrated outwardly. So, like, the fearsomeness is probably an internal thing. It's a grit, you know, it's a resilience that sometimes he doesn't have too often on these big pressurized situations. He used to.
If he's not to, as Shane said, if he's not to change his nature, if this is his nature, absolutely, you've to thine own self be true.
Mm.
But there's a reference to Jack Nicklaus shooting in 83.
It's in Dermot Gleeson's piece.
Back, I don't know what year it was, but it was a long, long time ago.
81.
And he had been told that his son was in a serious car crash just before he went up onto the first tee.
Yeah.
He was clearly shaken, and he hit an 83. But his response was interesting in that he didn't reflect openly with the media. He pulled a select group of scribes aside. He brought them into the inner sanctum of his changing room. He explained the detail, and they said, obviously at this stage he was reassured around the health of his son, and they said, what do you need? And he said, well, right now what I need is I need to shoot a 63 to stay in the cut. And he went out and shot it. From a nature point of view, that obviously shows he's one of the all-time greats. And I don't think there's any apology for Gleese comparing McIlroy with him, because he'd won four majors before 30, and he does seem to aspire to be considered among the greats. If he is to be considered among the greats, he probably does need to look at that nature. I'd love to see him say a few choice words, smack a golf club against his bag, figuratively speaking, get a slap in the face, or actually get a slap in the face. It's like something to shake him out of this philosophical slumber and actually get aggressive about his golf. Because more talent than most in the world.
He did say on Thursday, funny enough, that he was planning to meet his parents that night, and they wouldn't think any less of him for shooting a bad round, and his friends wouldn't think any less of him, and he still has a great life.
Mm.
Is this too much perspective for you in a top-level sportsman? Is that almost what you're saying?
Yeah, I think he's overly reflective, overly philosophical. I think it can be corrosive sometimes, reflective practice. You can navel gaze and go introspective as long as you want to go. Sometimes you just got to get pragmatic, angry,
ruthless.
He needs to add those into his game. I have no doubt they are deep down in the well in there somewhere within him, because you don't get to his level without it. I just think he's chosen a route of being able to reason his way out of everything, and you can't. So he's so natural. He probably needs to go back to natural naturally as well.
Would you think that over-reflectiveness affected Harrington? Is that not something similar to what he would have had?
I think it's the classic golfer climb up your backside in terms of paralysis by analysis. You know, accept there's going to be good and bad days.
But Harrington was obsessive. You know, Harrington was not... I don't think Harrington too often was talking about, you know, well, he still has his family and he has a great life. I think he was obsessive with his game to his detriment in the end. He would argue against that very strongly, but he was obsessed. He wasn't talking about, well, I've got a nice life and my house in Florida is nice and that kind of stuff.
He claims he said he needed to try harder at relaxing, which is
the
irony.
That's actually very interesting, because if you look at James Corrigan's piece, James Corrigan has in the opening paragraphs where he's talking about why did it happen, at the end of it he says, McIlroy so obviously cared about missing the cut in front of his home fans on Friday night, he cared too much.
Mm.
And then if you jump to Dennis Walsh's piece where he's looking at Shane Lowry said in the interview that he thinks that Oakmount won't happen again because he doesn't care as much.
I know. See, this is what I mean. You know, it's all nonsense, really, isn't it?
It is.
It's speculation,
You know, the narrative is completely based on the result.
And speaking on Lowry, he has just made a birdie on the fifth. So that's birdie, Shane Lowry. So he is now five shots clear at the Open. This is a serious performance. He drove up to about 30 yards short of the green, played a pitch to about 8-9 feet beyond the pin. It looked like it'd be a bit too much, but he held the putt brilliantly. So he now moves to the par 3 sixth, Shane Lowry, with a 5-shot lead over Tommy Fleetwood. Lee Westwood is 7 shots back. Larry's out in front. This is his to lose now. That's a lot to carry around when you're only on the fifth, sixth hole, but he's carrying it well so far. On them, by the way, the golf coverage, Paul Kimmage has written like a series of vignettes. You both like this piece, where he's talking about really why he loves golf and how he's come to love golf. But on the pain of the thing, he's talking about McIlroy's opening tee shot, and he says, the thing about doping is, because he's comparing sometimes the experience of cycling and golf, the thing about doping is that you can set your watch by it. The dopers are as quick in the last week of the tour as they are in the first. They're always fresh, rarely sick. There are no bad days. I thought about that watching Rory on Thursday as he hit his tee shot out of bounds and started the Open with a quadruple bogey 8. That would never happen to Lance. It would never happen in most sports. There's a pill you can take for that in the other sports. I was absolutely gutted, but I walked out of the media centre that night feeling strangely elated as well. This is the greatest game in the world. Was one of his vignettes.
Yeah, it's really, really good. You can imagine, obviously, Kimmich and most people, just that you get this tremendous fascination from something where one moment of a mental breakdown can just cast aside the best of the best.
The margins are so insanely fine.
It's incredible. It is incredible, because you wouldn't, you're not going to get, you can see where it's coming, you're not going to get somebody who's going to lead the Tour de France from start to almost finish and then collapse just at the finish, you know, because they've mentally broken down. Whereas obviously that's very, very much what you can get here, and we're all sitting down today, you know, wondering, you know, will Shane mentally break down? Fingers crossed, looks like it's not going to happen, but it's the kind of thing that can happen, you know?
I think the interest inside of Paul's article, you know, there's no performance enhancing pill for skill level. And there's actually a piece on page 12 by Eamon Sweeney that looks at Djokovic versus Federer and why, for example, everybody was so, in particularly on court in Wimbledon, so clearly on Federer's side, that there seems to be a common sense among the tennis community that Federer restored that idea that there is no performance enhancing pill for skill, because at one stage, before his dominance, male tennis had become an ace fest, you know, a single serve, games were not rally based. It was his skill level that actually helped transform the game again, and he kind of evokes this joy among fans that he recovered or rediscovered skillful tennis. And they talk, Eamon Sweeney goes on to talk about that versus Djokovic, who represents the robotic, physical, hugely impressive athlete, but versus the skill level.
More manufactured.
Is it more manufactured? Yeah. Do we love Lowry slightly more because he has, you know, he's there's the Nike ad. There was a video going around on social media last night. It's the actual Nike ad that McIlroy features in. The clock keeps going 5 a.m. He's doing press ups. He's drinking spinach shakes, and then whatever video was sent out and re-edited, the last scene is Shane McIlroy Shane Lowry having a couple of pints and saying, "We're going to enjoy tomorrow." I don't think it questions McIlroy's regime, in as much I don't think it questions Lowry's regime, and they're all able to relax and enjoy and have a beer, I'm sure. But it's just, what do people find joy in? Do they find joy in skill level? I think Kimmage loves golf, he's saying, because the comparisons with Tour de France, where it's so physical by nature that there was always a response that was more predictable. But no matter what, how you train and what you do in the golfing arena, you can go out and hit a 79 on day one when you're the hot favourite, and no one's cracked it yet.
I think the other reason that Kimmich, I know he doesn't go into it here, but so I'm probably speaking about us all more broadly, but we're absolutely blessed with the personalities of the Irish golfers that we've had for the last couple of decades. Good. Like, I've never played 18 holes of golf in my life. I'll tune in for the majors and I'll stay with it to the last day if there's an Irish player involved, right? That's as much. And I would sit down and read about McIlroy, Lowry, Harrington, McGinley all day long. Yeah. They absolutely fascinate me as individuals, and the differences between those personalities as well, you know?
Yeah, no, it's true. We're reviewing the Sunday papers with Andy Dunn and Shane Keegan. On the rugby front, I guess this is going to be all over the papers pretty soon. It's still building slowly towards the World Cup at the moment. There's nothing really on the Irish team as they go about their business in Carton House and elsewhere. But Rory Keane in the Mail on Sunday, Andy, is writing about South Africa and specifically Razvi Erasmus and the job he did at Munster and what he's doing with South Africa. They beat Australia yesterday 35-17. I know you watched that game in the Rugby Championship. The All Blacks, without their Crusaders contingent, beat Argentina 20-16. So Rory Keane on Erasmus, the byline is, since cutting short his initial three-year contract with Munster, Erasmus has been preparing to scupper Ireland's World Cup hopes. They could very well meet in the quarterfinals, Ireland and South Africa. So what jumped out of you for people who haven't read this piece?
Well, the potential to meet in the quarterfinals alongside the headline waiting in the long grass, I think, is quite apt, because even based on yesterday, which was their first foray into this World Cup run, they looked very, very impressive. He picked a kind of a young, inexperienced backline with great pace, actually, and a debut for Herschel Yanchis at scrum half, who scored two tries on his debut. Right. He's diminutive. It's great to see guys of his size and physique surviving in the international game. He scored his first try, and Eben Etzebeth is about 6'8", hugging him.
What he is diminutive these days?
Well, he's 5'5", five foot six. He's absolutely tiny for modern day professional rugby.
You're going to tell me 5'10", 11".
Oh, diminutive, yeah. No, he's properly small.
Okay.
Very muscular, very, very fast.
Sure.
Very opportunistic. He almost went kind of underneath the peripheral vision of a couple of guys with a second try. He ducked so low and ran around the scuttled his way around the side of a ruck when nobody really could see him or expect it. So, but to go ahead and do that, Erasmus, give a guy who was relatively unknown his debut in the lead up to the World Cup. He picked a very fast back three, two wingers and a fullback as well. Their scrum looks really physical and dominant, and really took apart the Australian scrum. So for the waiting in the long grass headline, it is, I suppose, a little bit of a worry when you just see that performance on the first up from South Africa. We are going to play, with all things going well, we're going to get to a quarter final with this team.
Yeah.
But it will be against, if things go to plan in the group stages, it will be against the South African side. So,
Rory Keane writes that Erasmus is now master and commander of South African rugby. He has arguably more power and influence than Joe Schmidt and David Nusafora combined, which gives you a sense of just how powerful he is. They talk about how this has all come about, really. Maybe the plan wasn't for him to go in as head coach, but the Alistair Coetzee run was so terrible with, 11 wins out of 25, that Erasmus came in as head coach. He denied he had any role in Coetzee's dismissal. But Rory Keane says, you never really know with Erasmus, a unique character who can appear equally engaging and aloof. Talks about various things he's done, appointing Kulisi as their captain from the township in Port Elizabeth, South Africa's first ever black captain. One of his first acts as head coach, Erasmus stated publicly that he didn't appoint Kulisi as some grand gesture, but because he was the right man for the job. Bristled at suggestions that Kulisi is a marketing tool and not a real leader of this squad, as has been said in certain sections of the South African press. The 2-1 series win over England last summer, the win over the All Blacks in Wellington. And they say as well, he has he's got rid of the rule on selecting overseas-based players with less than 30 caps. He's got that struck off. And the conclusion is that the 46-year-old Erasmus has assembled the strongest Springbok squad since the World Cup winning class of 07. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. I think it's a really interesting insight to his character as well by Rory Keane. He asked the question, is he a Mayfeiner, for example, or is he a canny operator? And there's evidence to suggest both. Some smart arse then in Limerick had said it just as well, his name was Erasmus, referencing the Erasmus programme. He only ever wanted to be here for 1 year, get as much experience as he could and go back and use it against us. But he's still spoken of highly in Munster by players. I think he seemed to have the capacity to hold the media in his hand. He had a very, very difficult first year.
Yeah, horrible.
On the back of Anthony Foley's death. And he dealt with it in a really impressive way, I think. Now, they also won 19 of their 22 group
regular
games in a season that disrupted and that emotional. That's a huge achievement. So
because he engaged with the emotion even personally, and yet I felt also kept things as level as you could be. I think he found in a very difficult year a good balance and handled that well.
He seems, you know, I suppose you'd if you were talking about it politically, he seems very, very astute.
Yeah.
He knows how to gauge the emotion in a room. He knows how to get the best out of players. He was an incredibly talented player himself. Mm. A physically tough guy, but a very skillful guy on the field. But he kind of comes back to me, the Rory Keane quote, is he a Mayfainer, is he a canny operator? There's just nice insights to him as a character. Going ahead and getting rid of that overseas rule, for example, to me is just smacks of pragmatism. Go and get your best players. And he went on a tour around the UK and France and talked back five or six of their best players for the World Cup.
Ulster's Marcel Casilla played as well.
I mean, he's in a World Cup year, no one's going to remember that rule if South Africa go on to win it.
I do remember,
he's not going to be criticised.
I spoke to a player who played under him at Munster.
Yeah.
And 18 months ago, it was a vague World Cup chat. It was going to do well. Mm. And he said, watch South Africa.
Mm.
I said, really? He said, Erasmus.
Yeah.
Erasmus, Erasmus, Erasmus. This guy's serious. He'll have them pitch up and be in brilliant shape.
Yeah.
Guaranteed. So that started the worry.
Hence the waiting in the long grass from Rory Keane, I reiterate. I think, and then having watched it yesterday, just how dominant their scrum was over Australia. And now Australia were missing two props that featured in the Super Rugby tournament from Brumbies, who were excellent. So they weren't at full strength, but they demolished their scrum.
And it's
interesting to note they don't really ask their prop forwards to do a whole lot else except scrummage.
Okay.
And we seem to be asking our props to do a hell of a lot other than scrummage. So.
Okay. That's on page 68 and page 69 of the Mail on Sunday. Also in the Mail, Shane, we have Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. It looks like an exclusive. I haven't seen him elsewhere, but he's been speaking to Joe Bernstein and Philip Quinn because there is a Roy Keane angle here. Is on the back page. He's taken some quotes from the Solskjaer interview with Bernstein because it seems Ole and Roy Keane have struck up a bit of a friendship. He's been around the house for tea.
Yeah, he has. And I suppose initially the bit that I found amusing was... Ole almost seems hesitant to, am I allowed to call Roy a friend? Anybody who's said they're Roy's friend of recent seems to get shot down by Roy very quickly after claiming to be a friend of his. But you can imagine that Solskjaer might be the kind of fella that Roy would warm to. He's kind of laid back and
if you can't warm
expressionless
to Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as a person,
that's
you've got seriously high standards
That's certainly it. So he says, I know Roy did an interview saying there are many people that claim to be his friends, but I feel we are quite close. We have become friends, but as I say, it's almost like, am I allowed to say that? Look, I don't know if there's a massive amount in it.
Yeah.
You would have a kind of a thing to yourself. You'd love to have been a fly on the wall just for that conversation. Look, you'd love to be a fly on the wall for any Roy Keane conversation, really, wouldn't you? But
well, it seems he went around to get Keane's thoughts on how he should approach this season with the players.
Yeah, and that in itself is not a bad idea. How many useful nuggets of information Roy gave Ole is probably open to debate. Some would say he would be able to give him some, you know, very good ideas. Others would say, what the hell is he doing talking to a fella who's tried and failed at management a few times now?
Well, Bernstein points out that Keane did say of the United dressing room just last season, there's too many bluffers there and they threw Mourinho under the bus. They're Keane quotes. So his opinion of the players is not high.
Oh, that's, well, look, his opinion of most people isn't high. But yeah, he probably had fair reason to come out with comments like that. I mean, within the piece, Bernstein actually says, to be fair to Solskjaer, his eyes are very much wide open as he tries to rouse the biggest club in Britain from their post-Fergie trauma. United finished 32 points behind champions Man City last season, and Solskjaer needs new players, a new attitude, new fitness levels, and new leaders to close the gap. That's an awful lot of new, isn't it?
Yeah. You know? If you're looking for a semblance of hope, Manchester United fans, he is putting the end of season dip down to the fact that he looked for too much from the players physically, and they didn't have the work done at the start of the season to be able to sustain that. Like he says, the stats say my first game in charge when we played Cardiff, that was the second highest in intensity of pressing in any Premier League game last season. That work rate hit us in the end. But now we've had the chance because of what the players have done in training over the 3 weeks. They had their programs over the summer, and it seems like they did them because they were fit when they came in, comma, most of them.
I wonder, did Pogba do it?
Yeah, I know. He's looking to replicate that early, those first 7, 8, 9, 10 games where they went virtually unbeaten and pressed teams. His plan is to play that way across the course of a season, and feels that the pre-season will allow them to do that. That is the slight bit of hope for Manchester United fans.
What I'd say is he kind of, you know, he talks about Roy being one of the great captains and pretty much hints at the lack of personalities that United haven't appointed a captain yet. So, I mean, it's not just a hint. He clearly is struggling to find people of captaincy material. I would say that quite often people of captaincy materials are also people who work very, very hard on the pitch. So, you know, I'd say if he's short of captains, he's possibly short of guys with massively high work rate. So it's one thing getting them physically fit enough to go through the Klopp-like intensity in games that he wants them to do, but have they got the mentality, have they got the want to go and work as hard as Klopp has Liverpool working, you know? It brings us kind of from one piece to another. I know we were just going to touch on it as well. It does look as though he has made one move in the right direction, which is tying down David De Gea, which is a huge thing for them, aside from his, you know, bit of a dip in form towards the end of last season. But like, how could United possibly claim to be potentially moving in the right direction if David De Gea had been let go? Like, you know, as I say, even those who would have been critical of his dip in form, they would still, I'm pretty sure, say that David De Gea is in the top three keepers in the world, and it was imperative that they held on to him.
He's going to become the world's best paid goalkeeper, up from 200 grand a week to 375k a week, and that's De Gea over the line for 6 years. On the whole leadership issue, Solskjaer says, Andy, we had the likes of Brian Robson, Gary Neville, Roy Keane. Anyone would love to have them as a leader, but that's just society nowadays. There aren't many of them left. It's one of the great cliches.
Well, I think he's making a strategic error regularly by he's name-checking all the former greats, and he would almost genuflect in the presence of Alex Ferguson by the sounds of it. And I think being a staunch Liverpool fan, I started about age 5 or 6, so I barely knew what it was because my dad supported them. But by the time I got to 10 or 11 and they'd won 5 leagues in a row, and suddenly it dried up for 30 years. Suddenly for 30 years doesn't quite fit, but it dried up. Mm. I think the mistake Liverpool made in the 90s and when Souness took over, and there was this constant romanticism and harping back to the Liverpool way and the boot room and the tactics and Dalglish and Shankly. And now Liverpool fans are painful at the best of times, and they still go on like that. But ultimately what has changed in Liverpool is a guy who's come in and grabbed it by the shackles and changed it entirely to in his own way, in his own format. And he doesn't constantly refer back to Dalglish and Shankly. And I think United are stuck at the moment with a guy who sees that as a valuable way to get buy-in from the fans. But I think they need, it's a huge, huge club. Potentially they need someone with a bit more strength and conviction about his own specific way. Now, he learnt the Fergie way. He's a disciple of Fergie. But I think they need Fergie to probably take the, you know, reverse out of the situation a little bit too. And going to chat to Keno and Brian Robson and whoever else was involved in the glory days, I don't know if it's the ideal way to approach this season. That, you know, the societal issue of we don't produce leaders like that anymore, I'm not so sure I agree with either. It's a different question.
Yeah, I'm not so sure I agree with it either as well. Yeah. Maybe a different style of leadership, but there's plenty of leaders.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, final few bits and pieces here on the paper review with Andy Dunn and Shane Keegan. You have some GAA in front of you there. Colin O'Rourke's piece, Andy.
Yeah, well, I it was an interesting one about the Dublin Roscommon game, and I have to go on the record again as a staunch Dublin fan, but it's nice and interesting to hear a Meath man almost defend the honour of Dublin. But he talks about the kick pass, which I think is very instructive. Dublin's quality in terms of their kick passing, to particularly in the opponent's half, is, he said, something that very few other sides are even trying to introduce into their game, and questions why. I mean, there's a lot of question marks around funding and numbers and how unfair it all is, but he says surely the best way to try and emulate the top teams is to copy them. And why are so few teams copying that simple skill that's been part of GAA since its inception?
Mm. Yeah. Anything else from GAA grabbing you?
Yeah, he has a piece on the opposite page as well, Colm, and just listening to Billy Joe's report there, Colm is not a fan of the Super 8s. He said that before. I think he actually sums up at the very, very beginning very well. He says there are not 8 super teams, and this is probably where it falls down. If you know, the great thing about the Munster Hurling Championship last year and the Leinster one this year is because you had so many teams of an even standard. And in fairness, if you had eight strong teams, then the Super 8s would be fantastic to watch. But we don't. We have one super team, and we have 3 very good teams, and then a good few teams that are a bit below that. He does actually say further down in the piece that he says if both games finished a draw today, and then if the opposite teams to last weekend won next weekend, wouldn't it be great to see all teams finish on 4 points? Because that would just help him, I suppose, prove his point that how ridiculous it is. But look, it's a good piece. He looks at does a decent bit kind of leading into both games. Obviously, I think Kerry Donegal is probably going to get overshadowed later today by what's going on with Shane Lowry. But in itself, it's a cracking game. It really is an absolutely cracking game. So it is. Probably more so, cracking is maybe the wrong word, fascinating game. Because you're going to have 2 very, very different styles in football. He talks just briefly again, Sean Patton, who has been really, really impressive for Donegal this year. Yeah, in goal for them. He's been a very good shot stopper, but I think it's his distribution that has really, really caught everybody's eye. Like, it's only 18 months. I tried to sign Sean at the start of last year for Galway United. I mean, Sean was a League of Ireland goalkeeper for, you know, the last 6-7 years of his life. And we had a conversation where I was trying to tell him, there's no point, you know what? You're going to be number 2 and you're going to be sitting on the bench and blah, blah, blah. If you go back to the Gaelic football, he's been excellent. He really, really has been excellent. And I think he's one of the biggest factors in their transformation to genuine contenders again, if there is such a thing as a genuine contender outside of Dublin. But no, I think that will be a very good team. Colm says Donegal are a very good team Donegal are a good team with the potential to be a very good team, and I think that is very much the case. They need to, in the same way that you look at David Clifford and you go, he's a class act. The support cast looks a bit stronger to David Clifford than maybe the support cast looks to Michael Murphy at the moment, and maybe that's the difference, and that's maybe why you'd edge. You look at a potential Donegal Dublin final and you say, is Jim Gavin really not going to be able to come up with a game plan to just solely stop one player and that potentially be the end of them as a realistic threat? I think he could come up with a game plan to stop David Clifford, and there will still be more concerns then to try and deal with around that. But at the moment, there does still seem to be an over-reliance on Donegal. That, added to the injury to Eoin Gallagher, means that you would certainly favour Kerry this afternoon. But I think it'll be a cracking game.
Hopefully, yeah. Last story, you were a physio for a while with the Irish cricket team, or working with them. There was a piece which caught your eye.
Yeah, I was there in 2014 at the World Cup in glamorous Bangladesh, which I wouldn't advise anyone to go and visit if they're interested in tourism. But Jared Sickens covered. Yeah, well, I mean, on a momentous week for Irish cricket for a number of reasons. Eoin Morgan, born and bred in Dublin, played for Rush out in North County Dublin, and moved over to England because Ireland weren't a test nation. So he moved to England with a view to his mother was born in England, so he qualified through that, and he went with a view to playing test cricket, and he did indeed achieve that in the initial stages of his career, but it didn't go very well for him, and he ended up being the shortened form of cricket, being the captain of the England team for one day international cricket. So last week, while there were 1,000 viewers, Sky Sports GAA viewers, there was a reason for that in the UK, because everybody was watching either Wimbledon or England win the World Cup. So a born and bred Dubliner winning the World Cup for England, which was quite amazing achievement for him. But this week is Ireland's first ever test match in the home of cricket, Lord's Cricket Ground. And they're playing England starting on Wednesday. And it's the culmination really of 15, 20, 25 years work. And Jared Sickens really, I suppose, pays homage to that, but also questions that the team selection, and it's quite an ironic twist that the team that really got them into Test cricket is still the team that remains. There's eight players still in the starting 11 that were there when I was the physio, for example, back in 2014. So it's not a very dynamic selection policy for any international level sport. 5 years later, to have the vast majority of the team exactly the same. So he brings into question the succession planning. There's a young guy, for example, called Lorcan Tucker, who's an excellent wicketkeeper, who's thereabouts on the team, but not selected this week. Mm. He's preferred, the position that's picked is a guy, Gary Wilson, who has picked as a specialist batsman and wicketkeeper, has one century in his last 276 caps. Right. Which, by any stretch of the imagination, is not a great record for a specialist batsman. So it's an interesting angle from Jerris Higgins. It's not entirely celebratory, because it is a celebratory moment, but he does question succession planning and how the Ireland team are going to optimise being a Test nation.
It's good, though, isn't it? Clear-eyed.
Yeah, very much so.
Fellas, we're out of time. Thanks so much for coming in. Shane Keegan, thank you.
Thank you.
Andy Dunn, thank you. I'm sure see you more as the rugby... heats up. That is your paper review for today. Shane Lowry's just bang one down the eighth. He's just off the fairway in rough. Doesn't look too sticky, but more importantly, he is six shots clear through seven at the Open at Portrush. Short break.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by Avantcard Reward Plus Credit Card. Powered by MasterCard. Straight up better than your current credit card. Avantcard DAC is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.